Okay, so imagine this. You're a young rising photographer working to really stand out in a hyper-competitive industry, and then you get a call one day from Iman and David Bowie asking you to shoot the cover of Iman's next book after two covers shot by two of the world's top photographers had already been rejected. Well, that is exactly what happened with my guest today, Indrani Palchowdhury. And she rose to the occasion and absolutely knocked it out of the park. That moment would become an inciting incident, leading to ever more opportunities to deepen into her wildly imaginative and really compelling magical realism style and launch years of award-winning collaborations, image-making, and storytelling with everyone from HBO, Vogue, Vanity Fair, Pepsi, Nike, and L'Oreal to icons like Beyoncé, Gaga, Bowie, Kate Winslet, Pharrell Williams, Eugene Braverock, Jay-Z, and just countless others. And Indrani's work is exhibited in museums worldwide, in the permanent collections of the National Portrait Gallery and the Smithsonian. And over time, she has integrated her love of image making and storytelling with this lifelong passion for service in the name of social justice and impact, and expanded from still images to film, including directing the powerful Girl Epidemic documentary about sex trafficking and slavery. And beyond directing, advocacy has really taken a much more central role in her work and life, with positions as the co-host of the Global People Summit at the United Nations, the host of New York Live Arts Humanities Symposium, and co-founder and executive director of Shakti Empowerment Education for Women and Children in India. She also lectures at her alma mater, Princeton University, on mobilizing millions with art and film for human rights and social justice. So excited to share this conversation with you. I'm Jonathan Fields, and this is Good Life Project.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Good Life Project is sponsored by the ADHD Aha podcast hosted by Laura Key. So I've been kind of amazed at how many conversations I've had lately with people later in life who are wondering if they have ADHD. It can be hard to understand what ADHD is by looking at a list of symptoms. So in each episode of ADHD Aha, you'll hear heartfelt interviews about the unexpected, emotional, even funny ways that ADHD symptoms surface for adults. Like the recent episode with ADHD coach Emily Weinberg, which really resonated with me. Her story about how she was thinking she was, quote, just lazy before her diagnosis because she wasn't hyperactive really struck a chord. Her feeling frozen and stuck, ruminating on mounting to-do lists is just so relatable for so many people. It's really validating to hear others articulate those experiences. Each episode of ADHD Aha features candid tales of realizing that you or a loved one has ADHD. You'll hear the unexpected, emotional ways that it manifests in adults through heartfelt interviews. ADHD Aha captures the authentic human experience of ADHD. So if you want a fresh, personal perspective that embraces the messiness, listen to ADHD Aha. Search for ADHD Aha in your podcast app. That's ADHD Aha with Aha spelled A-H-A. It's an aha moment you won't miss. I know you were born in Calcutta, spent the first 7 or so years there. And I guess your mom was British, working in service of Mother Teresa when you were a kid. So you were sort of around that whole ethos at the youngest of ages.
Yes, I was part of the volunteering process because I translated for my mom. My dad's Indian, and growing up bilingual with a mother who wasn't, it was very essential for her. So from the age that I could translate for her, I did. And so I was very much involved. And at the home for the dying, the orphanages, it was a very intense environment, but I saw it as beautiful. I mean, these were people were my friends, and I felt very useful, you know, from a very young age. I felt needed, and that was incredibly empowering because I, you know, just having someone to talk to for someone who's going through an end of life experience is incredibly powerful. And particularly being a child, I think I was particularly loved and needed in that situation. So it was very transformative. Throughout my life, it's been something that I go back to as you know, those moments when I need to find my better self. I remember that we all have that ability to help on a very fundamental level.
Yeah, I mean, to know that from the youngest age, and to know from the youngest age that simply your presence can make a difference in someone else's life, I think it's really powerful, because I wonder if some of us actually never learn that, you know, let alone later in life, if not ever.
Well, it's a lesson that I was fortunate to learn, but I've often forgotten. And, you know, you have to keep reminding yourself that life isn't about what you take or what you get out of it, but what you can be for others, what you can provide. That's where true happiness comes from. And I feel in our culture here, we have it inverted. And that's why people are so filled with misery. And when you look at a place like India, which objectively has so much suffering, and people are, there are so many millions who don't have enough. And yet there is a much greater sense of peace, a greater sense of harmony for the most part.
Yeah, I have always been fascinated by that as well. It seems to me that a lot of cultures that focus more on the inner life than the outer life are the ones that seem to, at least from the outside looking in, be able to identify with a greater sense of ease, even in hard circumstances. I don't know if ease is the right word, but a sense of meaning, a sense of, you know, value in life and purpose in life around them, even in, you know, while the outer life may be quite fraught.
Yeah. Yeah. And one of the interesting things that I learned from that experience with Mother Teresa, and I got to sit at her feet in Sunday school and run around. I didn't know how important she would be to the world. At the time, she wasn't so famous. In fact, there was a documentary that was what caused her to have that global renown. And ironically, that's part of what I do now, is help to amplify stories. But my experience with her was interesting because it was often surrounded with her strength of character, but also conflict, because people like my mother, who's a very strong character herself, had different ideas about how things should be done. And so there was a lot of voices raised and tempers running high. And I realized that, you know, anything that you do with great passion, there is going to be tension. So we often think of someone who's trying to do good as being this force of peacefulness and calm, and it isn't necessarily like that. But the results are also complicated of Mother Teresa's work, and I've studied them more in depth as I've grown deeper into my own social justice practice and come to realize that, you know, my goals in life are not the same as hers. But you know, we all have to find our own paths to peace.
Yeah. The other thing that occurs to me in that experience is that at a really young age, the experience of impermanence is being normalized,
yes,
which is something that, again, at any age, especially in Western culture, we don't talk about it. We don't acknowledge it. We pretend it doesn't exist. It's this horrifying thing that we, you know, it shouldn't be a part of the human condition. And yet here you are at the youngest age, single digits, and it's around you every day. And it seems like you found a sense of peace with that, and understanding that it's natural and it's okay, which is kind of astonishing.
Well, it's served me very well in my life to have that foundational understanding of impermanence and also the value of suffering in a certain way, which I don't mean that lightly as in, oh, one should be grateful that you have suffering. But there are so many wonderful things that can come of suffering that one doesn't recognize necessarily in the moment. But understanding that context, I think, helps. I often feel that children that grow up insulated from trauma, you know, which is what people tend to want to do. You want to protect your children from those experiences. But then when they come across it, as they must in every life, they don't have the tools to deal with it in the way that they would if they had been able to understand it better from a younger age.
Yeah, so true. I think as a parent, you know, every parent, you ask a parent what they want for their kid, and the first word out of their mouth very often is, well, I want them to be happy. But the deeper truth is, before any of that, they want them to be safe. But sometimes we conflate safety with safety from anything that might in some way make them not happy, which means that we take any form of adversity out of their experience. And we don't realize that we're also removing the capability to deal with adversity because they never develop those skills and learn them. I think it's such an important idea.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you're being brought up in this extraordinary environment from the outside looking in, but you know, I'm guessing for you, this is just your lived experience. This is your life. This is your day to day. It sounds like also you gravitated, I think as so many kids probably growing up in that tradition, to a lot of Indian mythology and stories and culture, which are so rich and vivid. Tell me more about your sort of gravitation towards that.
Well, I was very fortunate to grow up in this rich culture, and my parents were humanists and feminists and very determined that I learn all cultures. But of course, growing up in India, the culture that was had the greatest influence on me was the Indian culture. And I grew up in a big extended family, which means I had 300 family members that in the Indian tradition, you know, we think of as families. Here, we tend to lose touch with people a few generations removed, but there it's a vital part of life. So I got not only my parents' perspectives, where they took me to church, to the mosque, to the, you know, temple, to each try to have a balanced view, but I also grew up with these amazing festivals, and I remember very keenly one of my first memories is being in a festival to Durga, who's a goddess with 1,000 arms, and she rides on a lion, and everyone calls her mother. And I distinctly remember thinking that she actually was my mother, and the person that I was, you know, had been born to was sort of just this temporary character. And so I had a very profound influence on me.
Yeah. I mean, when you look at some of those stories and your attraction to them as well, there's some really fascinating foreshadowing, right? In the work that a couple of decades later, really, in the voice that you would find in image making, which is sort of similarly magical and fantastical.
Yes. The creative force that unleashed.
Yeah. What happens at 7 that leads the family to leave?
There was, in Bengal at the time, there was a lot of unrest. There was an uprising. And my father, who was the chief financial officer in a tea company, he was actually trying to help the workers to get paid properly. There was a lot of issues of people not being properly taken care of, the workers. And in any case, this uprising led to terrible situations where heads of companies were being held hostage by the workers. And it was terrible for the workers because then the police would come in and tear gas. And it was a very destabilized moment in history. And my parents just decided that they wanted me to have a an upbringing without that kind of conflict, and they were very afraid, and they were concerned too that I wouldn't get as good an education there as I could elsewhere. Of course, looking back now, I realize that, you know, there's wonderful education to be had everywhere, but certainly in India, for a young woman growing up at the time, it felt like opportunities were less prevalent. Mm-hmm. So we moved to England and then to Canada, and it was a very destabilizing time for me. I loved my life in India, and my life in England was very, very different. So I suddenly, everything was turned upside down for me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you go from knowing the environment and the culture and having 300 brothers, sisters, cousins, aunties, uncles, you know, like around all the time, to then dropping into a place that you don't know. And then, you know, it's just you and like like small family unit, especially at that age. I have to imagine your head was spinning in so many different directions.
Yeah, it was very hard. And getting to know my mother's family, you know, you grow up with childhood myths of, oh, these wonderful people over there. And finding my mother had a very traumatic childhood, and I didn't know that until that point. And so it was very hard to deal with the change. I changed completely as a person. I became withdrawn, and I ended up hospitalized with something that every time I go to the hospital, it would get better, and I'd go home and I'd get sick again. So it was like some kind of traumatic experience for me.
Mm. So when the family then goes, so I guess it goes from the UK to Toronto then?
Yeah.
Which Toronto, I don't know about then, but I know Toronto actually has a really substantial Indian community.
It does now, but at the time, we felt very alone. We weren't part of the Indian community there. It wasn't a very big community at the time. It's grown dramatically. But my parents were kind of, I guess they were also shell-shocked by all the changes. You know, they had a very rich life in India, and my father couldn't get a job in Canada. He was an accountant due to racism. So it was very surprising. He went there for a job, but then it quickly went away. And my mother ended up working as an accountant because she's English. And even though she hadn't studied it, she'd bring the work home and my dad would do it. So it was this crazy world where although he had all these skills, they weren't valued because of his race. And my mother, who had none of the skills, was able to get the jobs, but she had to hide the fact that she was, or she ended up hiring my dad as her assistant, and so she had to hide the fact that they were married. It was a very complex situation.
Yeah, I mean, have you, in hindsight, have you had the opportunity or ever sat down with both of them and sort of asked them about what their real experience was during that sort of season?
Yeah, well, we were very close, so I was very aware of their experiences, and I'm actually working on a film that's their story, and it's been really, really interesting to go deeper into those experiences.
Yeah, because I would imagine, you know, as a kid, you're, especially at that age, you're so very often me focused. It's like my world has been turned upside down. I like all my friends, all my family, and this is so hard for me. But it's got to be fascinating when you have the chance to sort of understand what your parents are going through and see them as human beings and as, you know, like partners in life as well.
Yeah.
And negotiating those agreements.
Yeah. Well, that became very complex. And then I had a stepfather who is Jamaican Rastafarian. And so I was raised with him as well, and his family. So I had this wonderful multiplicity of influences, and I was very close with him. And he suffered from schizophrenia. So that was a lot of very intense experiences, but he was just a wonderful, wonderful human being. So I was very fortunate.
Yeah. I wonder if to a certain extent also the experiences that you describe, again, it's so interesting, like the way that all this mythology starts to foreshadow and the voice that you would take on in image making down the road. There's so much chaos. There's so much complexity in your early life, and you've got to figure out a way as a child to navigate it, to be okay with it, to make sense of it in a way that is not unique to the sort of the much higher stakes world of image making and filmmaking down the road. I wonder if you have any sense that was almost like a laboratory or a proving ground to help equip you with those skills.
Certainly. And I think dealing with mental health issues in one's family, I think, teaches one a great deal as well in terms of, you know, how the words you use are interpreted by others, how to help others to find others that you care about to be in touch with their better selves and yourself as well. So, you know, that complicated sort of negotiation, you mentioned that word before, certainly became a part of my life and became a really useful skill when working with celebrities and actors and artists, you know, bringing people together. It is kind of a mad process. There is this chaos of different opinions and different perspectives, but that's where the magic happens when you can bring them together and find a way to harmonize between them.
Yeah. And for the record, we're not saying that all celebrities have mental illness.
Not at all.
We're just saying there's a lot of, there's a lot of struggle and complexity and just a lot of stuff going on.
Absolutely. And that, the creative spirit is itself.
Exactly. Yes.
Conjures a lot of emotions.
Indeed it does. When does the impulse to tell stories through imagery or to create images, and I'm guessing, you know, you would never have used that language as a kid, but when do you start to become aware of that impulse being something meaningful to you?
Oh, I began to be obsessed with photography and at about the age of 13. Mm. And then at 14, I went to visit various studios because I wanted to intern. I wanted to learn photography properly. And they laughed at me. I was a skinny little Indian girl. And they said, "You can't carry stuff. What what use are you to us?" But luckily, along the way, a couple of them said, "Well, if you just sit there, we'll photograph you. And you can learn from that if you want." I said, "Great, that sounds wonderful." So I started modeling. And it was just getting in the door and getting to learn from these artists and then getting to travel around the world and work with some of the greatest photographers and filmmakers was really, really exciting.
So this is happening also in your teens. So you go into this place wanting to just learn the craft and they're sort of like, no, be on the other side of the camera. How does that turn into, okay, just local, be on the other side of the camera because we don't think you're capable of actually helping in the production side of things, to modeling? And then I can understand how that happens on a local scale, but it sounds like pretty quickly, this becomes a big thing in your life and becomes a source of, you know, you're going to school, but you're also modeling, you're traveling around the world, you're being paid, you're like, this becomes a teenage career for you as well.
Yes. I struggled because I was very short, but I had a great deal of ambition. I didn't think I was particularly attractive. So that was good. And it was my insecurity, I think, which actually helped to helped me to not get too caught up in it. But I did spend many years traveling the world while studying. I'd go to Tokyo or Milan or both in the summers and then go back to school. And even during school, I was working. And initially, it was the attraction to learning and also being able to help with my family's financial situation. I went to a private school. They wanted me to have the best education, but they couldn't afford it. And so, you know, I'd be brought into the principal's office and told, "If your parents are late again, we're going to have to kick you out." And, you know, so there were all those financial pressures and with the mental health aspects as well, it felt, you know, I felt very thrilled to be able to help my family.
Yeah. As you're doing this, it sounds like, you know, you're checking some boxes in terms of service to the family and helping out. But also, you know, it sounds like you're very much a student of the craft, like kind of taking notes on what's happening, you know, other side of the camera the entire time.
Yes, I was. And even with the modeling, I went to the library and I read every book there was on modeling. You know, I'm a nerd. I still am. And that's sort of the foundational approach. I went to modeling school and I negotiated a class that they gave it to me at a cut rate because I was so convincing that I was like, look, I already know a lot of this stuff. So I definitely took a very serious approach to learning about photography and then filmmaking through that process. And it was an extraordinary experience because what I realized later, having many interns myself, you know, it's hard for them to learn necessarily when they're off actually doing stuff. So I had the experience of just getting to sit there and watch, which and be in the center of the action all the time. So I learned a great deal from it.
Yeah, I would imagine. I mean, I would imagine not just about the craft, you know, like how do you create the shot, but also I have been on many different sets, whether, you know, like film or photography, and the dynamic on a shoot can be healthy and constructive and productive. And it can also be the exact opposite. And I have seen both ends of the spectrum. And I would imagine that your lens on not just the craft, but just on the human condition was probably taking the culture of the process in as well.
Yes, very much. And I think that that, you know, being a woman as well, I think I wouldn't have had that opportunity had I not modeled, because women typically are not chosen as assistants, and they have a hard time, you know, getting in the door and getting to experience much of that. And so yes, I learned a great deal about the business side of it as well, and also what it's like being directed by someone who has a very, you know, there's often a confrontational kind of approach of the photographer trying to pull something out of you and you're resisting because, you know, and so I got to learn both what works and what doesn't work from the perspective of the being the subject of the shoot.
Yeah, I mean, and it had to be so valuable. We had Mark Mann on the show a little while back, who, you know, like takes all these iconic super close up, super shallow depth of field portraits of many celebrities. And I remember him sharing that, you know, he saw a lot of this same stuff. And one of the things that he loves to do is literally show up with just him, like not even an assistant. And just, and he said it was, you're always trying to figure out, like, there's a moment that, you know, like if you're lucky, it happens and you capture it. But so often that moment was elicited from just real easy storytelling and conversation and like creating a really gentle interaction with the person that you're shooting. And it, so it's so interesting to see how people approach it so differently, but I think all with the same end in mind, like they want to create something extraordinary.
Absolutely. Well, there's so many ways to do it. And of course, I think that through my career, I've experimented constantly with different approaches and different ways of connecting. Because ultimately, I think, you know, as a photographer, as a film director, what I'm always looking for is that divine spark within the person, that way of that moment when it's almost like they open up, or there's a little crack and you can see something that's profound and true and that connects the viewer to the viewed, you know, that there's this moment of magic, a moment of recognition, a moment of truth.
Mm. Do you know it in the moment when that happens?
Sometimes. Well, I've worked so many different ways. So I had a partner for the first part of my career. Our approach to photography together was we kind of created a distraction for the subject. Our dynamic, we had so much tension between the two of us that often put people at ease, because then the focus wasn't so much on them. So part of what was fun there was sort of allowing the music and fun and dancing and those things to be sort of a focal point, and letting the subjects not feel like they were as much under the gun, because we were so busy, you know, tearing each other. That's what I came to realize was sort of the method we developed. But as I've been a solo artist, my approach has changed a lot, and it's I'm a very calm kind of focused person, and so I think that the nature of the work that I've done is also evolved more. When I worked with David Bowie, you know, a big part of our shoot was talking about the meaning of life and the universe, and, you know, these, you know, theories of whether there are aliens. I mean, we had these beautiful, amazing conversations during the shoot day, and I think that kind of comes through in the images as well. So each shoot is different.
Yeah, no, I would imagine.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Good Life Project is sponsored by Quince. So my wife actually originally introduced me to Quince because she loves their clothing, and I have been hooked ever since. I literally lived in their Mongolian cashmere ribbed beanie and pullover hoodie pretty much all winter. And as the weather warms up, I wanted more breathable summer pieces without overpaying. And Quince has just the super high quality items like linen shirts, performance polos, activewear at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Quince partners directly with top factories, cutting out the middleman to pass savings to customers. Actually just ordered a new European linen long sleeve button down shirt. Super excited to get that. And I'm always just so amazed at how they can keep their prices so affordable while the quality remains really high. So if you're looking to upgrade your wardrobe, I highly recommend you try Quince. Go to quince.com/GLP for free shipping on your order and a 365-day return. That's quince.com/GLP to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/GLP or just click the link in the show notes. Trust me, your wardrobe will thank you. Good Life Project is sponsored by Lumi. So listen, we have all had those awkward moments where a BO strikes at the worst possible time. I'm often actually out in nature when I'm exercising, so I don't even notice it when I'm out. And then I walk in the door, kind of start to wrinkle my nose, and then I'm like, oh, wait a minute, that's actually me. That is why I'm so thankful I discovered Lumi Whole Body Deodorant. This revolutionary product, it was actually invented by an OBGYN who wanted a solution for her patients struggling with private odor. But Lumi doesn't just work, quote, down there. It provides incredible 72-hour protection for your entire body using mandelic acid. I kid you not, this stuff is a game changer. Lumi is safe and effective for pits, for feet, you name it. And as someone who's tried it, I can attest that it seriously works. The fresh scents are just an added bonus. So if you're ready to say goodbye to BO for good, try Lumi's Starter Pack. It comes with a solid stick deodorant, cream tube deodorant, two free products of your choice like mini body wash, and deodorant wipes, and free shipping. As a special offer for our listeners, new customers get $5 off a Lumi starter pack with the code GOODLIFE at LumiDeodorant.com. Don't miss your chance to experience the relief of true full body freshness that equates to over 40% off your starter pack when you visit LumiDeodorant.com or just click the link in the show notes and use the code GOODLIFE. We took a bit of a jump here. You fill in just a little bit. You're building on this experience that you had. You end up finishing school, spending these years, and then and you end up at Princeton. But if I have the timing right, before Princeton, you actually take about a 6-month photo pilgrimage. You go back to India.
Yes.
And then at the same time, end up starting a school for 300 yes. or so students in this interim window. What was going on there?
As a model, I got to, an actress, I got to travel the world, and I saved up money along the way. I didn't get lured into all the ways that models often end up disenfranchising themselves because they don't have a goal. I was always very, very scrupulous. So with the funds that I'd saved, I took my parents back to India. We hadn't been back for over a decade. So that was really exciting, just getting to reconnect. And then I did this 6-month pilgrimage around India, taking photos. And it was a spiritual pilgrimage as well. I went to the mountains and looked for Shiva and found all kinds of interesting things. But I also went back to my home where I had this really transformative experience. I arrived with my parents to my home, and there were refugees living all over in our family home. They moved in all different parts, and a lot of the family had moved away. It's a very large family home. It's like a palatial ruins. And I was angry when I saw these people, and they're like, that's our garden. That's where the roses were. And there's people living there, and they're like, have goats. And at first I wanted to get them out. I was like, this is terrible. We need to rebuild the wall. They've broken the walls. And I had this amazing conversation with my father, because I was crying at the same time by seeing, you know, how they lived. They were living in such terrible, they had really nothing. They were refugees. Their kids were half starving. I mean, it was a mess, you know. And I was like, well, how can we get them out? But then where did they go? And at the same time, I wanted to help them. And my father said, you know, if you got them out, you know, what do you think would happen to them? And that really got me thinking about, well, this is all they have. And in fact, you know, I don't need this. You know, they're not taking something away that's taking away from my ability to survive. But I can't be okay with the way, you know, that they have no, there's no future for these kids. They're working in the fields and factories if they're lucky. And so I traveled around the country and thinking about, you know, what could be done. And I just realized just the great need and how fortunate I'd been. You know, I often had thought of myself as hard done by, you know, having my family having financial challenges. And then I realized, you know, how fortunate every single one of us in the West is. I mean, even the homeless people have far, far more than the homeless people in the third world. So I really wanted to help. And I changed my way of looking at them and thought, well, what can we do to serve them and to help them to be able to have a meaningful future and be able to help others too. That became really, really exciting as we built the school. And initially I started on my own as this crazy idea, and I convinced my dad. He had always wanted to give back, but he wasn't ready to come and move there and take care of things, but I couldn't manage it on my own. So he did. He had just recently retired, and he did move back to India to run the school, and he's been running it ever since. I've been the director of the school, and he's on the ground doing the day to day. So yeah, it was very exciting recognizing that the process of learning to help others is what teaches one the most. And so that was a big part of our approach with the kids and then with their mothers as well, as teaching them to teach others so that they could learn how to create a better life for themselves.
And this is all on the grounds of what was the old family home, or was this a different location?
Yes.
Right. So you essentially turned that home, that location, into a school. And rather than saying, how do we take it back? You're like, well, what if we did the exact opposite?
Yeah, exactly. How do we give it to them fully and make it count, make our efforts, you know, have a lasting positive result rather than just leaving the status quo. And then ultimately we ended up actually purchasing another building, because with the family, there were a lot of different factions and not everyone was on board with the idea of bringing the poorest of the poor into the home. So initially we started that way, and then we moved it to a new building. And in that building, we actually do weddings in the evenings, which helps to fund the school. So it became a self-perpetuating system.
Oh, that's great. So your dad ends up staying there, running the school. You come back. Princeton awaits, studying anthropology, but still shooting the whole time, because now at this point, photography is you know, it's a DNA level impulse for you.
Yeah, and actually, prior to starting at Princeton, I started my photography career professionally, and I met Marcus, who became my partner, who is a classical harpist. So we met the year before I started at Princeton, and we started doing photography together. We went to Paris and we had a lot of success small things, but we got published in various magazines. And so I had all these years of experience in photography. He had none, but he had bought a bunch of expensive equipment. And I met him 2 weeks later as he was testing it out on unsuspecting subjects. So that's how we began our career together.
So the harpist who had really cool equipment and the person who has the impulse and the desire and the experience. Perfect.
Yeah, it was.
What could go wrong there?
His motivation was meeting beautiful girls, which is the motivation for many, many photographers, I have to say. But you know, I put an end to that as well because we became a couple. And then I did go to Princeton, but I was working full time the whole time. So going back and forth.
Yeah. I'm curious why, I mean, beyond the fact that it's pretty hard to say no once Princeton has said yes, but you kind of know what this thing is inside that lights your fire. You're doing it. You're succeeding at it professionally. What was the impulse to still say, well, I'm still going to go to college?
I've always been very hungry for knowledge, and I have to thank my father, both my parents. They gave me a lot of freedom from a very young age, which is unusual for an Indian family. You know, I traveled the world and they trusted me to do that. But the deal always was that I would eventually come back and go to college. And so I did take off that time, and I felt that I had to follow through. And I studied anthropology at Princeton, which allowed me to go deeper into my fascination with human nature and learning these sort of scientific basis upon which decision-making occurs. And it was really fascinating. So I loved it. And my only regret was that I didn't spend more time at Princeton and less time doing the photography at the time. But of course, once you start a career and it was going well, and then David Bowie saw our work, and we had, you know, all of these surprising things started to happen with it. It kept calling me back, and I spent most of my time doing photography.
Mm. So it sounds like the one of the really big early catalysts, one of the big early inciting moments that sent you in the direction that you've been going for a long time was this connection with, I guess originally it was Iman and then Bowie.
Yeah.
I'm curious how did they first discover your work?
Well, I'd been shooting for a number of different magazines, really underground little magazines in England. And then a makeup artist saw some of the work. And it was really crazy, the image. I discovered the digital aspect of photography at that time. I was probably one of the first to really explore all the possibilities of what you could do with photos in the computer. And as we started shooting digitally, it just opened up more and more doors. So my early experiments were putting people on other planets, they were, you know, turning humans into aliens, you know, really playing with those sort of goddess references. So really out there kind of work that fashion magazines were like, what is this? They didn't really get it. But this makeup artist loved it and showed it to Iman. And Iman was working with David Bowie on her book. So this was the first book that she created of her life. And it was a retrospective of all this incredible photography. And David was the art director on the book, I believe. The book was called I Am Iman. And they had shot the covers twice with two of the top photographers of our times and rejected them. And they decided that they wanted to try someone new that, you know, and go for, rather than looking backwards, looking forwards to what was coming next. And that's how I got to do that, that shoot. And I pulled on my anthropology studies and created Iman as a fire goddess, as an African fire goddess. And so that was really exciting, getting to bring those things together.
So walking into that shoot, knowing that you've got Iman and Bowie as your clients and that they had worked with two of the top photographers and rejected them, pressure?
Every step of my career, when I've done anything worthwhile, it's been under tremendous pressure. And you know, growing up in the chaos of Calcutta really prepared me well for that. I think I work best under pressure.
Mm. Well, clearly you created, you know, an extraordinary image. And it seems like that was also, you know, that was the opening move in you doing a lot of work with various people at super high profiles throughout the entertainment and the music industry, and also taking that same style, that magical realism, that sort of fantasy, and saying, let's see how far we can push this.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And I think that that my studies really did help that. I went deep into mythologies around the world, and they always somehow were the refrain that were in the back of my mind whenever I was on set. I was always seeking to connect with those mythological heroes through the subjects that I was working with. So it was a fun way to explore human potential, and combine the artistry of the person that I was working with sort of this older traditions chain of mental imagery that mythology creates.
Mm. What, I mean, it's fascinating to me on so many levels, but you end up working with people who are emerging and at the top of the fields, from Beyonce to Gaga and all these different people who have their own really well-defined, not just brand, but image of what is the story that I want to tell? What is my sense of taste? What is my voice? So I'm curious, when you bring your background, your sense of anthropology meets, fantasy meets realism, and then you're working with people who have such a strong point of view, I would imagine that there is a lot of fire in those interactions that could go either way.
I never had that experience.
Really?
I mean, I keep my fire on the inside.
Tell me more about that.
I'm very easy to work with. And my approach has always been, let's discuss what it is that you want, and how you see yourself. And let's start from there. Let's look at your work. So I would study deeply the work they'd done before, who they were at that point, and create my own projection of where I thought they could go. And while from the outside it may appear that these artists have this very strong self-image, that is created in collaboration with the people around them. And so, for example, with Beyonce, when I photographed her first, she was with Destiny's Child, and I photographed the group together. We experimented, we did nice pictures, but we didn't really have the opportunity to take it very far. It was one of those quick shoots. We did some sort of flying through the air kind of ideas. So we did start a little bit on a goddess trajectory. But when I was asked to photograph her solo debut album art, again, it had been photographed by two other photographers at the top of their careers and rejected. And so this theme continued throughout my career and still does. But anyway, it was very interesting because she and her team, they all had very different ideas for her. Her mother brought these long, elegant gowns. The record label wanted her to be young and hip. And she wanted to, the word she kept talking about was universal, powerful, this idea of dance, bringing that together. And of course, for me, that's a goddess, and then that imagery really came from my tradition. And it was only later that I realized just how much the image that became her Dangerously in Love album cover, that it is exactly a replica of the dancing Shiva, the Nataraj image, which I had a beautiful statue of that I brought from India. So it was something I looked at every day. And recognizing when I put the photo up that somehow we'd recreated that. That was really fun.
That's amazing.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
At the same time that you're doing this extraordinary work and working with some incredible people, and as you've described yourself, there's a lot of fire internally with you. And I've also heard you describe yourself as on the quieter side, on the more introverted side.
Yes.
Raising my hand along with you, by the way. And behind the camera, you know, like you are the one who is collaborating to create these extraordinary images of other people. And yet you find yourself at a certain point being the focus of a series on Bravo about you. So all of a sudden, you're the subject of the story. You're the one with cameras trailing you as you're out there doing your work. I'm curious how that experience was for you.
Oh, that was a very tough experience. That was definitely one of the hardest experiences of my life, because having the camera on me, of course, I had to dress up. For many years, I dressed in baggy pants and shirts. I didn't want the focus of energy. And you know, I put out everything I had into making my subjects as magnificent as possible. I didn't want to distract from that by even spending time to think about what I was going to wear. So suddenly we have this show. I had to look good. I had to represent, because, you know, ultimately that's part of it. You become a subject, and you have to think about your audience. And so much of the show was constructed. And the show actually was my initial idea. I created a pitch, but I was interested in the creative process, and I wanted it to be about how a group of people come together to create these identities. And exactly the question you're asking, you know, how do we create these brands, these icons? So that was the objective. But of course, we didn't have control over the edit, and the things that were chosen were otherwise. But that's another story. But it really had to create scenarios. And that's really how my filmmaking career started, was immersing myself in that process, again, from the inside of how do I tell a story that I'm okay with, rather than the story that the network, they want drama, they want interpersonal conflict. And we certainly had plenty of that.
You got to have your beats. What is like every 90 seconds or something like that?
Right. And so in order to get anything of meaning into the show, I had to create those scenarios as well. And the shoots, many of the shoots were artificially constructed for the purpose of the show, in the sense that they were real shoots, but, you know, we wouldn't have done them if it wasn't for the show, because our actual shoots that we were being paid to do, people didn't want to have those seen, because the network refused to give any assurances that they would edit anything out. So Lady Gaga and Kim Kardashian and all of these wonderful people agreed to come on our show and trusted us, even though the networks wouldn't give them any assurances that they'd be kept safe. So we had to negotiate. And part of the reason I wanted to do the show as well is I wanted to bring the audience to India, into the school, and to help promote that, because it was really important for the school to increase its fundraising. But also I really wanted to inspire young people who are fascinated with celebrities and fascinated with fashion, and recognize the beauty of giving back and how important that had been to my life.
Yeah. I mean, that's such an interesting bridge to make, because, you know, we do have, we're living in a culture now that is fame obsessed to a small part. And I remember seeing a study, I think it may have come out of Harvard 3-4 years ago, where students were asked, would you, upon graduating, actually it wasn't coming out of Harvard, but it was, Harvard was in it, that students were asked, upon graduating, would you rather be the assistant to a famous person, a celebrity, or the president of Harvard? And the assistant won hands down. It wasn't even close. In fact, it was the winner was to be the assistant to J-Lo. And in fact,
that's a hard job.
Right. Second to that was being Jesus. So it was a really interesting statement about how fame obsessed we are, not for what we might do with that status, for that renown, but simply for, you know, like the ability to be that way, and to be in that circle of fame. So what makes me is that, you know, this was really, you were trying to bridge the gap, you know, between being super high profile and then asking the question, well, what do we really do with this?
Yeah. Yeah. And the school for me had always been my motivation to work so hard. I love photography and I love working with these wonderful people, but I wasn't really that excited about, you know, creating advertising and fashion images. I mean, it was fun to explore creatively, but ultimately it's superficial. And so if it wasn't for my school and needing to provide for those kids, I think I would have gone in a fine art direction much sooner and spent much more of my time on social justice than I did. But I did come to be able to do that over time, which is really great.
And you know, it seems like that moment for you was also a bit of a transition point, because you're, you know, this also launches you, it sounds like, much more intentionally into filmmaking beyond capturing stills, and focusing your lens on really with an activist orientation. So like now you're making images and now you're telling stories and now you're capturing scenes, but it's not so much creating fantasy and building up individuals, but now you're telling the stories of profound need, sometimes profound trauma. Human trafficking becomes the real focus of your lens and a film. And it sounds like that has remained, you know, a growing and growing part of what you're about and why you show up and do the work you do now. But there's an interesting dynamic there, right? Because when you're the filmmaker, you know, you're doing this dance, especially when you're talking about really traumatic situations, but also situations where other people have the ability to help. You know, you're doing this dance of, how do I tell the story in a way that invites viewers in, but also doesn't re-traumatize the very people that you're trying to help? I'm curious how that sort of like worked in your mind as you're doing this work.
Well, it's really interesting, because I jumped in, you know, some of my first projects were going to Central African Republic to film for the UN with Mandy Moore, a distribution of mosquito nets to fight malaria. That was actually my first commission. So I jumped right into what I really loved, because I separated from my partner, Marcus, and I just went for the things that I'd been unable to explore in our partnership together. So that the process was immediate for me. You know, you're jumping right in, and no one teaches you. You don't, you know, so many filmmakers go out there and they perhaps want to do good, but very often the very process of creating documentary is re-traumatizing the victims. I mean, it's so obvious. If you have any compassion, you can see that people don't want to necessarily share their stories. And I've seen filmmakers push people far beyond their comfort zone, push them till they cry. And then that's like, oh, we got the tears. And that's,
right.
That's
the sort quote, of the goal. The money shot.
Exactly. Exactly. And seeing how that, you know, sure, that filmmaker maybe is going to win an award and make lots of money off of this. But for that individual who then has to go back to their everyday life, and now with the fear that their secrets are exposed, you know, a lot of these topics are not only traumatizing for the individual, but certainly for their community as well. And reintegrating them is one of the biggest challenges, certainly in trafficking, but in most areas where people are traumatized. Helping them to overcome it requires so much effort. And I think that a lot of, you know, I came to realize through doing documentary, just how documentaries don't necessarily help. They can, but it's hit and miss at best. And very often, even a successful documentary can actually make things worse in various ways. So it's complex. And I wanted to, you know, really find ways to address the issues without creating harm, but creating good. So one of the ways was reintroducing fantasy, which I'm very passionate about, you know, those myths, doing scripted films based on real stories, but then taking those elements and bringing actors, or even like with the Girl Epidemic, which was on trafficking, I shot it with kids that are at risk of trafficking, kids who are actually benefiting from the nonprofit that brought me out there to do this film, but having them tell stories that weren't their own stories. You know, it was a level of remove that allowed them to have fun with it and be they're really familiar with the threats and what it might be like. So there was this realism, but it was a fun cathartic process for them and not in any way harming them.
Yeah, I would imagine it's such a delicate dance for anyone who has like a hardened sense of empathy, yeah. You know, and also a really interesting experience for you, because you clearly have this, you know, like fierce creative impulse and a strong sense of voice and taste. And at the same time, you know, when you're doing something like this, the fundamental question is, you know, like first, am I doing no harm? And then is this in service of that bigger thing that we hope it is?
Yes, that's exactly how I make every decision. And, you know, not to say that I always make the right decisions, but I certainly try to. I try to think it through and really understand the story before I jump in and create it, which I think, you know, that process of studying and research, you know, I use my anthropological methodology to really understand what I'm dealing with. And I learned a lot from those early experiences where I jumped in without that background. The malaria, mosquito nets, was quite an eye-opening project, because I learned that the peoples that we were there to serve, they had very mixed feelings about the mosquito nets. And as I was interviewing them, I was trying to understand, where does this come from? You know, and you talk to the authorities who say, oh, well, they don't understand, you know, they're simple or whatever. And I think, no, I don't think that's what it is. And it turned out that they were starving, that malaria, while it does kill huge numbers, most people recover from. So people have malaria time and time again, and they know that there's, you know, they have a chance of surviving, but starvation is not something you can survive. So they were using those nets to fish with, and the nets recovered in DDT. So lots of things that I learned along the way to look at the bigger picture and how, you know, how really we can help, and which is not to say that the mosquito nets are not helpful. They are, they're wonderful, but there's so much more that's needed in each of these situations.
Yeah, there's a level of nuance and complexity that sort of may not show itself on the surface.
Yes.
As you transition and make this a lot of the focus of your work and you're in these situations, you know, I've had a number of friends and spoken to many people who in some way, shape or form were involved with NGOs and they were on the ground or aid workers or even people who were in the media covering that for extended periods of time. And I know it can be really hard on you psychologically and emotionally also. I'm wondering how you just personally, emotionally, psychologically experience this work and whether there are things that you do to take care of yourself through it.
Well, I meditate. And that to me has been the biggest blessing. So that's how I'm able, I feel like it's kind of an armor that I put on each day, connecting to the source and reminding myself of the reasons why I'm there and how fortunate I am to be able to be on the side of helping them, trying to make things better. So I view each of these opportunities as an extraordinary chance to be useful. And so I think that I have a huge amount of empathy that's always driven me, and that's been how I've connected with the celebrities, and that's how I connect with survivors, and I don't really see any difference between them. I recognize how lucky I am to be able to learn from people who have had these traumatic experiences. Each of them has taught me so much. And so I go as a student, as someone who wants to learn what could be done to help them, and also trying to have compassion for all in the process, which is hard because I do get really angry at the perpetrators. And that's been a big process for me, is making peace with all the characters in any given situation. It's very easy to go in looking for justice and looking for retribution and those kinds of things. And while justice is incredibly important, a lot of times just helping people to survive, for me, takes precedence.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I know, you know, you were certainly a student at Princeton, but you also, you at a certain point were the teaching head as well. Tell me a little about this.
Well, over the years, I've worked with many different nonprofits, and that's been really rewarding. And I've worked on films that aim to help people to find their higher selves. And what I came to realize is that direct conversations with students can be even more impactful. And as much as through film and through nonprofits one can help, there is so much power in the one-on-one conversations that you have as a teacher. And through my school in India, directing that, seeing how those kids really thrive when given direction that motivates them, I was really drawn to speaking. And so even though I was really shy, I overcame that. I worked really hard to be able to articulate myself through words instead of just through images. And then I was a visiting lecturer at Princeton on mobilizing millions with art and film for social justice and human rights, which is my passion. And that was an extraordinary experience. And I'm continuing to teach now. So I certainly still prioritize creating in the world, but I balance that with teaching directly. And I had the privilege of being the organizer and host of the Art of Anti-Racism and Social Justice at Princeton, which was bringing together speakers and artists from various different backgrounds to talk about how we can use art to fight racism and to promote social justice.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. Feels like a good place for us to come full circle in our conversation as well. So hanging out in this container of a good life project, if I offer up the phrase to live a good life, what comes up?
I think to live a good life is about finding oneness with others, finding that divine spark that connects us all, and finding ways in which that connection can drive you to being your best self. So when you see someone suffering, that connection that you have to them is what allows you to have the ability to help. And it's a divine blessing to be in the position to be able to help others. So recognizing that for what it is, you know, that to me is the source of the greatest joy and goodness in the world.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening, and thanks also to our fantastic sponsors who help make this show possible. You can check them out in the links we have included in today's show notes. And while you're at it, if you've ever asked yourself, what should I do with my life? We have created a really cool online assessment that will help you discover the source code for the work that you're here to do. You can find it at sparkatype.com. That's sparkatype.com, or just click the link in the show notes. And of course, if you haven't already done so, be sure to click on the subscribe button in your listening app so you never miss an episode. And then share the love. If there's something that you've heard in this episode that you would love to turn into a conversation, share it with people and have that conversation. Because when ideas become conversations that lead to action, that's when real change takes hold. See you next time.